Hello and welcome back to the Sunday Podcast. I'm Ollie Lum and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Matt Seddon. This is episode 9 and we've got our first guest of 2021, Mark Hookway. Mark's actually the first coach we've had on as a guest, so we're very excited to have him on today.
Mark's an endurance coach at Tonbridge Athletic Club, who've had a huge amount of success in recent years. You know, if you know track and field in the UK, you're going to know Mark. We spoke about how he got into coaching and his evolving role at Tonbridge and how we can improve British distance running on a broader scale. You know, this guy's the godfather of amateur athletics here in the UK, so enjoy.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, good, thank you. Thanks for coming on.
It's all right, yeah. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, good stuff.
Thanks for asking me, I'm honoured.
Yeah, you're on our list from when we first started thinking about it, actually. Really excited to have you on. So yeah, just thank you for being so kind of accommodating and stuff, Matt was saying. So
No, it's I like a podcast and I also like speaking to sort of young people that are passionate about the sport. It's I've been listening to some of your interviews and your 2021 preview, and it's nice to hear other people that, you know, the younger generation sort of putting something into the sport and interested in it and making others aware. So I think it's a good thing to be involved with.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah. Thanks very much. Appreciate that. Yeah. If you don't mind, we'll just get cracking straight away, if that's okay with you.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
First of all, just wanted to ask you, and just, I guess, for the listeners and for ourselves, how you first actually got involved with the coaching side of things, obviously at Tonbridge.
Well, I got to 43 years old, I think, before I stopped running entirely with knee issues and things like that. But it was a case of my son was about 10 or 11 years old, and so was a friend that I'd run with for years, about the same age. And he'd started coaching 6 months beforehand. And I did a Kent Cross Country League, and I was probably running about 40 miles a week. And getting beaten by quite a few people that I wasn't very pleased about being beaten by. And I thought, what am I doing this for? And he said, well, why don't you come and run with the group of kids and do a bit of coaching? And we probably had a half a dozen at the time, and that was it. And that was about 2002, 2003. And Tonbridge, I guess, had a reputation for having some good spells with youngsters. Mid-80s, early 90s, particularly spells, but they typically would then go off and join other clubs or be lost to the sport as they went to university. So, I got involved then, and for some reason, and I don't know quite why, we decided with that little bunch of under-13s that we would support all the national championships and try and make it a team effort. And, so we went to Southern Cross Country, National Cross Country, and prior to that, I'd done the odd national and Southern and things, but as a senior, but not really. We weren't consistent with it, and we just created this little team that then one or two others joined, and gradually it snowballed.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because I think Matt and I were literally discussing just before you came on about how I kind of, from our perspective, Tonbridge has always been top clubs, and I think being the age we are, I think that crop of youngsters are our age group, I believe, because we're both 96, we're born, so I think the same age group as a lot of those guys you would have had coming through, and for us, like, always looking at kind of Para 10 rankings or, like you say, at National Cross results and things like that, Tonbridge have kind of always been up there. So kind of what do you think, like, I know it's not an easy question to answer, but what do you think kind of made that really successful period in that group of youngsters?
I firmly believe, and I've said this to a few people over the years, that probably every school year at every school has somebody who's a potential national champion, but they're just not unearthed. Mm. And yeah, I can remember when we started with that little squad back then in the early 2000s, one of our rival teams, if you like, as under-13s, was the Warrington squad. And there's always been little pockets around the country, Norwich, Bedford, Aldershot, of course, Liverpool, Harriers. And you look at every area and it's one, two, three people really driving it with a bunch of enthusiasm, never giving up, you know, just generating that team aspect, training as a group and things like that, that, it's not about the training. It's more about creating the environment where they just enjoy coming along, meeting their mates, go on a few trips, link up with other people around the country. I think that's really important, you know. And as you get older, I mean, you two guys probably know this. You go to university as a runner, you already know a few, even if you haven't met them in person. You know of them, or you know somebody who knows them, and that link up and that camaraderie, because we're all going through the same ups and downs, and having to put the same sort of effort in. And I think that sort of bonds people together. And I think if you can generate that atmosphere at a club, you can go a long way. And you still see it with, you know, I think Wolverhampton and Bilston have got some national medals in the younger age groups across country recently, and things like that. Wolverhampton and Bilston have disappeared in the 70s, but you know, it's clearly there. All it means is a few people have got back involved and pushing it along. I think also the vet scene has flourished over the years, hasn't it? And I think that's probably denied a lot of coaches or getting involved. And also, I think life stresses and pressures are perhaps greater today, and therefore the attraction of coaching, and it's not like once or twice a week, is it? To do it properly, you're doing it 5-6 days a week and communicating in between. It's not an attractive proposition unless you're really, really enthusiastic and passionate about it.
Well, I just want to put a bit of context for the listeners, Mark. You basically, when you went to Tonbridge in like 2003, would you just say they're a normal club, really? You know, there's a few different groups. There's a distance group, there's a sprinter group. And like you say, a little bit of success on the national scene as juniors, but not really much senior. But then now, 2020, you've won numerous national championships with almost like the same group of lads you started with back then. So we were just going to, touch on, I mean, I know I'm asked, like, what their success basically is. How did you keep them same people retained in the sport throughout that time? Because like you said, that's one of the biggest challenges. Because like you say, coaching is not just going down on a Tuesday and Thursday anymore when you want that level of success.
Yeah. Well, I probably wish I'd known back in the day when I started coaching what I know now and been through it all at least once, because I think every age group presents it. Particular issues. We've had a lot of talent. As I said, there's talent all over the country, I'm sure. I find it's almost tougher for those that are winning at a young age group than those that are further down the field. Because where do you go? You're going to be knocked off that pedestal, and a lot of people can't take that and struggle with it and are lost to the sport. So knowing that happens in the first place and warning people about that sort of thing at a young age, saying, yeah, it's great now, but you're going to come to some sticky periods and tell them in advance. I think that helps a lot. But one of the big things, and I think a major thing, is the move to university. And I think a lot, I don't know if I'm right, but I don't know what your feelings are, but maybe a lot of coaches and team managers almost say, well, cheerio, you're off to university. I can't do a lot with you now. I'll lose contact. And they go, and the athletes go to university, find a new coach, and almost give up on the previous coach they've had. And it seems to be one thing or the other. And I think the continuity, we've managed to keep going. And one of the benefits of being winter team manager for all the age groups at Tonbridge is I've got that excuse to stay in contact with people and be interested in how their training's going, whether they got any injuries, are they a bit down in the dumps, are they up for doing a relay or things like that. And I think that consistency of communication really helps a lot. And then again, when they leave university, I'm facing that now with a lot of them who have, as you say, come through the age groups. That's a big challenge, particularly this last year, where people think, why am I doing this? There's hardly any competition. I'm training hard. I'm as fit as I've ever been, but I'm trying to balance it with work. And so I think whichever age you're at, it's the coach sort of having some empathy and understanding of that and being there, being available. And I'm available through, you know, Zoom or phone calls or text or Twitter. I'm on Twitter, I'm on Facebook. I try and make, and I've heard some coaches around the country said, no, I don't touch Facebook. I don't want to know what's going on there. I don't do WhatsApp. Don't, you know, you think, well, perhaps you should do, because I think you've got to be a bit with it. You know, I've just turned 60, and I think you just got to make yourself accessible. And, you know, some people you could say I've fallen out with over the years, you know, I could easily have fallen out with because they've gone off and you don't get much communication. But I've never closed the door really to anybody. I've just try and keep that door open. So, you know, even this last week, somebody spoke to me, pretty much giving up the sport a year ago. Now he just wanted someone to talk to about how to get back into it a bit. And I think that's very important, all those things.
We're going to touch on your book a bit later, Mark, but from reading that and just from hearing, like talking to Tonbridge athletes and hearing a lot about you, that was one of the biggest things with me as well. Is that your communication just sounds like it's second to none. And in the book, it highlights that, you know, you're, like you say, people at university, you're keeping in contact with them. And when you talk about life experience as well, you're not just talking to them about coaching, you're talking about them, you know, about certain things going on in their life, which could affect their running as well. So, yeah, that's probably a key aspect to it there.
Yeah, it's hard. And, you know, you guys are obviously familiar with the Bracknell squad. And I looked at your dad, Jeff, a few years ago. I wasn't envious, but you had a cracking squad there, didn't you? With your brother, yeah. Sean, and who was there? Yeah, there was. And I thought, wow, if I only could keep them together. But of course, like us all, he then gets thrown them all going off to different countries, yeah. Different universities, different coaches, injuries. It's so difficult to keep it gelled together. And the lads help each other, to be honest. You know, once you get like a critical level, and they're interested in each other and they still stay friends and things like that. And they're probably their message to each other is somebody like Ryan Driscoll, he was in our national under 13 squad that won national cross country, and he's run 8:40 for the steeplechase and won the national under 23s. And he's been part of the senior teams that won road relays and national cross country championship. So he's a very sensible, mature guy that sort of person is very powerful to have in a group or a club. Mm. Yeah, and I can say to Ryan, could you have a word with such and such? Because I think he needs some mentoring or whatever. And that once you get a few older ones like that, that really helps. It's been a rocky period with some of them. If you've read the books, it's been horrendous, you know, at times, but some of them have come out the other side. I mean, Sean Malloy is a bit of a star at the moment. I was joking with him, he's going to be a great coach because he's made all the mistakes under the sun, but he's still at it. And I'm very proud of him. Very proud of him. Yeah.
I think that's it. Yeah. Do you ever think like, oh, if only I was able to just have them all together for like a little bit, you know, when they all part to uni, like same in my dad's group, like I think it was 2016, 2017. Uni came. Do you ever just think, oh, what could have been if they were just all, you know, all the group stayed together sort of thing?
It's an interesting question. I think
behind. Would they be better? Or
well,
would they be the same? Yeah.
The trouble is, what can you offer? You can offer a group to train with and mentor and help and such, but you have to go beyond that. And I don't know whether you read the bit in the book where we tried a project at Twickenham, for a group of lads.
I remember that, yeah.
Or some were at university, some just leaving university. The idea was good, costs a lot of money because, you know, you want them focused on the running, so you have to take other distractions out, and therefore they've got pressures of work and things like that. There's no real university around here. Even James West, you know, he was in America, just finishing off at Oregon now. He'd been to Loughborough, been to Oregon. I have really good contact. He still trains with the group when he comes back quite often. Always checking in on him. But I've said to him, you know, living at home with his mum and dad and just training at Tunbridge is not very inspiring. You know, some of them are pretty well, pretty driven and intelligent guys. And you know, it's a big sacrifice to give up, you know, study qualifications, work opportunities and things like that at the same time. Very few make it to a level, you know, that can earn a decent amount of money out of it. A classic is Chris Olley. You know, got a first class honours degree at Imperial College London in physics. Did a year at San Francisco, got a very good postgraduate qualification out there. And then worked for his internship company and has got a cracking job based in San Francisco. Yeah, nobody in athletics is probably going to give him those prospects. Maybe if he was the equivalent of Mo Farah.
Yeah.
Financially, he's doing probably better than any other athlete apart from the likes of Dina Asher-Smith. So you've got to be a bit realistic. And I'm quite proud of just about most of the Tunbridge guys who have had a plan B. They've got some sort of career going. They've done well at university. A lot of them have been club captains at university or social secretaries or whatever. So that's a good part of it as well. You know, there's one or two doing interviews and things like that. Like Sam Crick's got his own podcast. Yeah. You know, there's some passion there, and others have even become officials. So, you know, it's not all about getting them to the top. But I think if you just give them that passion for it, wherever they are, hopefully they'll stick with it. And we'll still be able to get some teams out if we ever get going again and things like that.
Yeah. I think like you mentioned their passion there, Mark. And I think from the outside looking in, I think a lot of that must rub off from you because you're clearly very passionate about athletics and passionate about the club. And you mentioned earlier just how it's coaching's not kind of a once or twice a week thing. Like what does a typical week for you, like in terms of Tunbridge, actually look like, and like just kind of explain to the listeners how much you actually put in, I guess.
Well, shall I go back before March?
Pre-COVID, please.
Yeah. I start on a Monday. Monday, typically, I'd be catching up with all the club results. In the winter, it's primarily the distance runners. I do the local newspaper report, update the club website, communicate that out to people. I do a weekly email as, I don't know what you want to call it, the Tunbridge AC distance running coordinator. I use my excuse as the winter team manager, but basically that goes to anybody who's involved in distance running, whatever age at the club. There's probably 350 people, you know, doing that. The club's about 900 membership now. So I'll update them on, try and make them aware of people's results from the weekend, what events are coming up, any news. I mean, things like last week, I was just making them aware of things like the Ingebrigtsens have got new episodes out on the Team Ingebrigtsen YouTube channel and things like that, just to try and keep people engaged, you know. So there'll be a lot of that in terms of communication. Monday evening, we had a little group, we'd just go out for a run. I'd cycle on my bike. Tuesdays would be club nights. We'd have a group of about 40 in my group, but there's 5 or 6 distance running groups at the club now, under 13s, under 15s, under 17s and under 20s, my group, and then what we call an adult development and masters group, which is probably 18, 19 minutes for 5K and slower. And so that deals with the social running club and the masters type athlete. And then there's our group, some of whom are typically away at university and things like that. So that would be Tuesday. Wednesdays, we'd have a circuit training session in the evening, which colleague Richard Owen would take and I'd support him with. Or I'd be off to Watford for a meeting in the summer and filming, of course, with the YouTube channel. Thursdays, we'd back to a club night. Saturdays and Sundays would be a race, or I'd be on my bike on the, you know, going with the athletes to meet up for a long run on a Sunday morning. And then in between, I'd be managing for, you know, whatever fixtures. Very full on in the winter because team managed for everybody. And then I got rid of the summer team managing because got so many athletes that I'm involved with, you know, could be competing here, there, or anywhere. So yeah, that pretty full on. I mean, now I've had a small group. We've been typically training Tuesday and Friday. We changed it, giving that extra day recovery, which works quite well. And also from the fact that the club has had to spread out across using the facilities because of the, we've only can have certain numbers at the track at any one time. So that's changed quite a bit. I've kept the weekly email going. I have a lot of dialogue with about 20 athletes myself, trying to get them organised, paired up, if they can, with each other to keep the momentum going. But it's certainly a bit quieter at the moment.
Yeah.
Huge amount of work.
Yeah, it's a pretty like full-on schedule though, and I think it's clear how much like time you put in. You mentioned that the Watford videos then. I know they're a kind of favourite of mine and Matt's, like those, and then like obviously the like Mansfield when you're there and things like that. It's just great that we can watch the races that we personally think should be like top of BBC's agenda, like your National Cross and things like that, because I think they're some of the best races there. But it's great that everyone can tap in and look at the filming you do. And I think the way that's come on as well, like the amount of cameras you now have on the course.
There's two of us.
Is it just two? So yeah, because like I remember thinking some of the recent ones, it seems like you've got people dotted around everywhere. I guess just a lot of running. Yes, so obviously you film races, you actually organised some races in the past couple of years, you've had your own podcast. Do you see kind of your coaching role progressing into something else at all, like in and around that, or maybe something else is what we were going to ask?
That's a toughie, yeah. I mean, this last year, I guess like a lot of people, was a chance to get off the conveyor belt a little bit and reflect. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because as I say, I turned 60 in September, and I could have easily gone another 10 years just doing more and more and more and more, and suddenly realise I'm 70. You know, that's healthy. I love the coaching. Think people like the British Milers Club. I've dabbled and helped out a little bit. I'm not quite sure where I'd like to go with it all. I think at one stage, as far as the video is concerned, I had this. It's not a plan, but this thought that maybe we could engage a younger generation of people to build a mix of these types of conversations, videos, like a UK flow track type operation. And people could send, I thought one stage I could accept videos from other people from up north or wherever, other events, and put them on my channel. But trying to do everything is just so difficult, and people have said, oh, why don't you charge for it? And I said, well, it's just us giving back to the sport. We're going to be at the events. We know people enjoy it. I really enjoy the fact that people enjoy it, you know, and they contact me and get a lot of good feedback, and it's just a goodwill thing. I've got the time to do it. So I don't know where I'd like to go. I really enjoyed organizing those races and the Tunbridge Twilight Meet and the Bromley Twilight Meet. And again, I'm blown away by some of the young distance runners around the country who commit and then will travel for nothing. And that frustrates me a lot, that people are doing a lot of this stuff for absolutely no income.
Yeah.
I'd like to find a way. And I think the national governing bodies could do a lot more. Firstly, by supporting the likes of Chris Barnes at the Podium 5K, the races he puts on.
Mm.
Again, similar guy, just puts a lot of work into it, free of charge himself. England Athletics supported the Bromley Twilight Meet, which really helped. Enabled us to pay for pacemakers, the venue, some prize money and things like that. I really would like to build on that, because I love watching. I think we've got a good depth in a lot of events, as you guys were talking about last week. I love seeing Brits race Brits in the UK. And I think a lot more could be done to help that. It's a shame. And then on the sponsorship side, I don't know why British Athletics don't have somebody dedicated that to almost link up potential sponsors with athletes to create some income for them, you know.
Ollie, we were talking about that the other day, weren't we? It's almost like the governing body has just become a bit lazy with putting on races. And now it's just sort of down to people like yourself, like running clubs as well. You're now just being like, oh, well, I'm going to put an event on. And the same with podium. And the governing body, bar like the national championships, doesn't seem to do much with regards to races and helping out, like you say, just that lower level, that sub-elite level that has so much depth at the moment.
I think part of that is the legacy we've had, which has been so focused on achievement of medals at major championships, hasn't it? So everything's been funneled towards that. And then on the other end of the spectrum is the mass participation and the sheer numbers bringing in registration fees for the national governing body and things like that. And there's a group in between that is lost, because distance running isn't necessarily contributing to the medal tally in a big way. And as I was talking to somebody yesterday or the day before, if Mark Scott turned up at Tunbridge Park Run, 600 people, nobody would have a clue who he is. Or a few would, but not many. And that until we resolve that, I think we've got a problem with the sport.
Yeah, I think that's it. I remember speaking to Jake Whiteman once. He did he was being introduced at Bushy Park Run, and they were reading out his 1500 times, and no one sort of batted an eyelid. They were like, okay. And then they read out his park run time. They were all like, oh, they all sort of raised and clapped. And they were like, goodness. And it's like, they didn't have any sort of bridge to the elites. Like, they just didn't know. And that's kind of what we're trying to do in a way, Lamami, is just kind of, it just needs to be more out there to try and bridge, like you say, your park runners and your fun runners to the elite a little bit. So then if once they get that following, then hopefully the sport will grow.
Yeah.
A little bit more monetized, I don't know.
Yeah, I listened to an interview with James Ellington. Do you remember he raised that money doing
crowdfunding
or whatever?
Yeah.
And if you, it really frustrates you. Go to Watford, one of those Watford Wednesday nights. What a great atmosphere it is. And knocking around the track will be a mix of like 11-year-olds up to internationals and beyond, And it frustrates me. And then you've got Love Island coming on or something like that. And there's so many good backstories in our sport, but that just don't get the opportunity to bring them out, and what struggles people have been through, and great personalities. I know you two were talking about Jess Judd. I mean, fantastic role model to so many people. And should be known by the wider fraternity, really, I feel. Lots to say, so I don't know how I do think the national governing body could do something. And maybe the athlete commission and that contact with athletes could promote that in some way, because there's a few issues there sort of linked that would benefit the longer term health of the sport, I think.
Mark, does it? I was going to say, like, we talk about you progressing roles. Does it take someone like you to, because I think it takes someone like you from your background to progress into like the governing body in order to help with that. Because at the moment, I just feel like the governing body, like you say, they're just so focused on elites. And I think they're missing a huge market. They might not think it's got much,
from.
Yeah. They might not think there's reality. Much money involved in that market. But I think with the numbers, there is.
It's not been very tempting to get involved. I just put it that way. They've been advertising for this head of endurance, haven't they? I don't know how far they've got with it. And if you think around the country, how they see head of endurance is perhaps different from most of us in the sport see head of endurance. I see somebody at head of endurance of being aware and in communication of, I don't know, the top 40 athletes in every event, men's and women's, 800, 1500, steeplechase, well, perhaps not steeplechase, but like, perhaps top 20. Mm-hmm. Whatever. It's not beyond the capacity to keep in touch reasonably regularly with each of those athletes and their coaches. How's things going? What are your aims for the year? What support do you need? Just linking them up with others who might be able to mentor them and help them, or physios or medical support or whatever. Just because if you've got a wide base to the pyramid that's very strong, the chances are you're going to get more to the top. That's how I would see head of endurance getting out to the club, seeing what was, just the best way of learning is from people who have done it or are doing it successfully, I've always felt. And I've been involved and mentored by people like Neville Taylor under the England Athletics Programme. I still talk to him, spoke to him this week. Totally informal, but we share ideas and thoughts, and that is the best way of spreading good practice and understanding and helping each other. And, you know, as you said, Rob McKim from Reading's helping my dad with Zach's training and linking him up with people. And I think that's what it's all about. But so isn't that what the role head of endurance should be doing, facilitating all of that?
Yeah.
And when I look around the country and think, who has that understanding of distance running through the age groups, at elite level, at club level, is good at organising, really good at communicating, knows people, there aren't many around. I mean,
I know.
James Thee, brilliant. You know, I'd vote for him, or Luke Gunn. My experience to those two guys, they're young, they've got wide experience, and this is a personal experience, their communication to me is spot on. When I text them or message them, you get an immediate response. I won't name names, but there's others around that are absolutely useless at that sort of stuff. And one of them might end up getting the job. And that would be a shame, because I think you've got to engage with the community.
I think that's a good point. I remember when Sean was just sort of getting on the cusp of, you know, breaking through in their junior ranks. And he was going to run for Scotland because his mum and dad are both Scottish. And
Sean Wiley.
And the Scotland were amazing. And I feel like they've carried that on. I know they've got quite, like you say, quite a wide pyramid almost, quite a wide crop of athletes. And they were just keeping in contact with Sean all the time, just saying, you know, what races do you plan on doing? And I think that was the year he ran 3:42 or 3 and qualified for the World Juniors. And he was like, well, I've got a few, but yeah, I need one a little bit quicker. And they were like, and I think they came back a week later, he was off to Germany and managed to race abroad through them. And they didn't, you know, and he offered him a little bit extra as well. But like you say, just keeping in contact with a few. But I know they were the same, you know, Josh Kerr at the time as well. They were the same for a lot of Scottish athletes.
Yeah, not everyone will make it. But Sean's somebody I know quite well because, you know, as you say, he's the same age as a lot of ours. Brilliant talent, lovely looking runner, had injury issues. I'm not quite sure where he is with them now, but you know, he's somebody like a lot of people who've run through the age groups and has the potential where, as head of endurance or, you know, working in that arena, you'd want to be absolutely sure you've done pretty much everything you could do to retain him in the sport. And you won't always succeed, you know, and I have what you might term failures, but you want to leave it feeling, well, I couldn't really have done much more. You know, some of it's down to the athlete or just circumstances with health. But you don't want to be in a situation, well, wonder what happened to him. You know, that's not good, is it? You want to know what happened to him. And yeah, I think there'd be a lot of people like that. And yeah, back in the day, you could excuse it because you could only write a letter or have a landline. But now there is absolutely no excuse for not getting good communication going with that sort of athlete.
I think that's it as well. I mean, when athletes grow up a little bit, they need a little bit more sort of support and gratification from people outside their, rather than just their coach. You know, their coach is just going, you know, you're really good at this, you know, doing really well. I think the older they get, they seek a little bit more.
I mean, honestly, if you were an athlete who'd improved a bit last year, and I take a guy who's improved from say 3:50 to 3:42 for 1500, he should be on the, you know, spectrum of being aware. Just getting an email at the end of the year saying, you know, well done, I've noticed this, keep it going. How's, you know, what's your plans or something like that, and just start some dialogue. I mean, that's what I do all the time at the club. Why can't somebody at the national governing body be doing that?
I think athletes, a lot of them just need to feel kind of just a little bit valued. There's obviously some personalities that are going to train hard no matter what. And some people are just very tenacious like that. But I think for a lot of people, it's people just want a little something, even if it's just that email and just being noticed, or someone taking an interest and saying, what is your training setup and how could we kind of give you some advice, like you say, to improve that or to just monitor that. And I think it would be, really helpful.
I try and do it at the club. Some of the club, I got the feeling that they got absolutely fed up with me ramming distance running down their throat. So years ago, I started my own website, called it tacdistancerunners.com, where I could just put everything to do with distance running. It wouldn't be of any interest to quite a bit of the club. But I would do things like each week, I would have the big hitter of the week, which is somebody who'd improved, with power 10 available, it's easy to count. Mm-hmm. It might be an under 15 girl who'd improved from 3 minutes for 800 to 2 minutes 48 or something. Mm. And I'd highlight that. And I include that in my weekly email, the ones that had improved the most. Because I often think, why are these people doing it? It's in this day and age where people want quick results, quick gratification, pats on the back for hardly doing anything. There's people battling away further down the field, not getting any recognition or even a pat on the back. And I think that's really important, whoever you are. Just you having me on here makes me feel good, doesn't it? So people need that all the time, I think. Yeah,
it's interesting. Let's get on to it then. Let's talk about the book. I know Matt's been really enjoying it. Can you just tell us, like, why, just for the listeners who might not know, like, why you kind of decided to write a book, and what it's really about?
Yeah, well, there's two books, because
I
probably got both, Mark.
Yeah, well done. Excellent. Come on, Tunbridge.
There we go.
Diary of a Dreamer, available from Amazon. Yeah, 15 quid each. And I'm collecting any royalties I get. I haven't been paid any yet, but I will put them aside for putting into any meetings or athlete support, because I'm not going to pocket it myself. Be interesting. I don't know if I'm going to raise much money. It's going to be more, perhaps if Netflix bought it, I might be able to put on some.
Yeah, you say that, Mark, but I've been telling, I've obviously got the books, and I know, like, I've been telling, my close friends and stuff who are involved in running, like, you need to read them, or you need to get them at least, because one thing, obviously, it's the way they're done is like just a diary entry, isn't it? Each day. And I loved it. In fact, the first one starts when the 2012 Olympics gets announced. And it's almost throughout the books, because it's a diary entry, I get to see how you relived certain big, points that have happened through the years in the sport and outside the sport. Like, I think you had, like, the London bombings, for example, and, you've noted that in there. And it's like, I can compare your, interpretation of those events against mine. And it's like, I'm reliving a little bit of history as well myself. I'm like, oh yeah, I remember, English schools in 2012 and whatnot. And that's what it was like for Mark. But on top of that, because it's a diary entry, you probably never envisioned making a book. I don't know if you did or not, but the honesty is just, so good to see. It's really interesting.
Yeah, I don't know quite why I did it. Somebody said, how did you remember all that stuff? And I laughed and thought, no, I didn't. Look, what I did is I just started typing notes out every few days.
Yeah.
And I think 2005, when the Olympics was announced, was a good time to start. And something prompted it, because we'd had a little bit of success, as I said, with under 13s. And I thought, I wonder where this is going. I'll start taking notes, because either it'll be a record of how impossible it is to get anybody to senior level and doing well, or it will be a good example of all the ups and downs that are needed to get there. And I started taking these notes, and I thought, a lot of the time, I'll tell you, the crappy, worst parts and experiences make the best stories, because if you've been through some pretty horrible times or whatever, or real struggle, or wanted to give up or whatever, that makes it so much better when you've actually had some success, rather than having a straight line easy, because it just. So I found in doing these notes on a regular basis kept me sane sometimes, because I kept thinking, that's a good story. You know, it might be horrendous at the moment, but this is a good experience. And hopefully somebody else might be able to learn from that eventually. I probably never thought I'd get, because I was so busy, I never thought I'd get around to actually, you know, editing them, proofreading them, and certainly not publishing them, because it would just be so much work involved. But then the pandemic arrived and I thought, what am I going to be doing across last summer? And I suddenly had this time. And despite my wife sort of saying, you've got to be joking, you're not going to publish that stuff, I started doing it. And I got, you know, one guy that was very kind enough to proofread it, colleague at the club, and he made some suggestions. And one of them was, there's a lot of detail. And that was what worried me. There was a lot of detail that would just be boring to people. So I put, every so often, I'd put in a block just with a message of something to highlight. So it might be, you know, we're talking about under-13s, under-15s. It might just put a little block in there saying, you never hear about Manchester United's under-15s team, for example. Yeah, basically saying getting them to seniors is the most important. Or it might be, it might be about, you know, winning everything under, you know, when you're 12 years old, and that's not necessarily the best thing. You know, it'd be just little bullet point messages. So I added those in and I kept reading through it. And then there was three or four stories in there where I really had to change the names. And my wife and a friend said, you shouldn't include them. And I said, well, I feel I've got to include them because I wanted it to be authentic about what I'd really been through. And, you know, if I was going to put stories about the athletes and the experience with them, I should put where I've made errors and felt that I could do things better. So throughout that whole thing, when I probably got to September and was getting to a period where I thought, oh, I'm close to being able to go live with this, I was still thinking, oh, there's a bit of sick. I'd never been so nervous, actually. Never, you know, going live and thinking, what's going to come back my way? And I thought, sod it, you know, I'm just going to go for it and see what happens. And the sales, I've sold about 300 so far, which I don't know if it's good or not, but there's 300 people out there. And I think it's going to be a slow burner, hopefully, that people will pick up and want to read it eventually.
I definitely think it's going to, you know, in 10 years time, someone might look at this, you know, and just be like, crikey, look, you know, look at the transition the club made. I mean, it's almost addictive, because when you open it, you'll be reading a bit and you get to follow so many different individuals. You know, you're following yourself and then you're following, say, James West, Sean, and then a couple chapters down, you know, it's the year on and you're like, oh, you know, I wonder how they're progressing. Anyone involved, you know, even you know, youngsters now, if they read it, they might be able to take something from it themselves as well, or parents, coaches. It's a book for everyone, really.
Oh, I'd really hope some of the parents would read it as well, because how they react and how they communicate with coaches and team managers, you know, it keeps people. Somebody used to say to me, whatever we do has got to be athlete centered. And at the club, a number of times I've said, yeah, that's all very well, but I think it's got to be coach centered. Coaches have to be motivated, enthusiastic, willing to invest their time for nothing. If you haven't got the coaches there in the first place, yeah, we had nothing before we started. It was, yeah, I think we had one person enter the county cross country championships. You know, that was it. It was that bad. It was, you know, between under 13 and under 20, had a splattering of seniors. And so I think everybody can take something from it. I spoke to Sean Malloy beforehand because I told him all the stuff I was writing in there, and he was really supportive and he's read them and he's fired up and training hard. And, you know, he's taken a lot from them. And
you he's part three.
Yeah, absolutely. I've started it. Yeah. He's the one who could probably complain the most, but he's actually been brilliant and supportive with it. I'm sure I've only heard from the people that are positive. I haven't heard from those that are negative. That's the thing.
Yeah.
Can't be any of them then, if you haven't heard.
Mm-hmm.
There can't be any of them if you haven't heard.
Well, I don't know. There's a few things in there where I've got frustrated with some of the lads or the fellow coaches, but I've tried on occasions to put the other side of the story. And I thank everybody because, you know, there's some friends in there that I've had arguments with, you know, the right way and the wrong way to do things. We have big debates within the club about should athletes train with their own age group or should they train with their own ability? And traditionally we've done it by age group because, as I said earlier, it's something where they come to be inspired by their friends. They compete as friends. They've got their teammates around them. And that's what, you know, some of us have tried to stick with that. Whereas if you've got a really talented 13-year-old, somebody can say, well, let's push them on a bit and move them in with 16-year-olds. But for a lot of reasons, I've never really personally wanted to do that. You know, there's some clubs successfully do it. And there's, yeah, I can think of reasons why it's a good idea, particularly when you get to 16, 17, you know, going out for Sunday runs with seniors and things like that. I think that's really helpful, probably healthy, you know, suddenly realise the commitment of some of the seniors. So there's lots of debates to be had around those sorts of things.
Well, I think keeping them in their age group, one thing about Tonbridge is the team aspect. I guess on the track, it's a little bit different, but definitely on the cross country. You know, and if they're in their own age group, they realise, oh, guys, you know, we could win a national medal. I know me at Bracknell, like, I love the national cross and I've been just saying to, like, yeah, that's why I get my brother to do it and whatnot. And I'm just like, look, can we just try and get six guys to at least score a team at the national cross? Because I don't think Bracknell's done that for years. You know, and I think when you train with people all your own age, you appreciate that. And you're all like, yeah, let's do it, you know. Like Mansfield as well, the relays. Like you say, you probably keep them in the sport that little longer when they feel like they're a part of something. As if you've just got someone training 3-4 years up, training with seniors, they're a little bit more individual and they're just like, well, you know, what am I doing it for?
It's very hard, isn't it, though? Because to get a team of, you know, six out, you've probably got to have 12 good people in the first place, haven't you? You've got to get that critical mass to be able to do it. And, we would lose people. Like, there was Andy and Alan Graffin went to Belgrave back in the, you know, about year 2000. Andy went to the Olympics at Sydney at 1500 metres and I think Alan won national championships. But they went because they didn't have enough people around them to create a good team. Now, I mean, Invicta AC are in Kent, they've lost so many to Aldershot over the years. You look back and think, wow, they would have had a brilliant team at one stage. And so you've got to get there quite quick to get a group of people, girls or boys, together who gel, support each other and have no reason to want to give up or go off and join another club or whatever. And that's quite difficult. It's so rewarding. You know, our best memories will be, you know, winning national team titles. I mean, you know, James West might win the Olympics, but probably it still won't be as good as Chris Ollie holding off Johnny Hay at Mansfield, to be honest, you know.
I think that's it, you know, people need to highlight the stuff a little bit like that, a little bit more, and appreciate that for what it is. Look, Mark, do you think, like, other clubs out there, do they think they can do what Tonbridge have done? Like, is it possible without someone like yourself? Because I was going to ask you as well, when you eventually leave Tonbridge or take a step back, you know, do you think it will continue its success? You know, the challenges, because obviously someone like yourself, you've given up so much time.
Yeah.
Not every club will be able to do that. Do you think they can reach the same level or,
Yeah, I mean, it would be a shame if it did go backwards. I mean, it's not all down to me. I've got a great team, six groups of distance runners at the club. We've got probably 30 sort of coaches or helpers involved to do that. And some just as passionate as me. They haven't all got I'm lucky enough that, I retired from paid employment over a decade ago. So I treat it like a job. So that, that enables me to do a lot of things. For example, you know, when we go to the National Cross Country Championships, you probably know, we take now 200 people. You know, there's 30 racing and 65, 70 supporting. And we've had three coach loads go. And we book a hotel nearby, and we have a dinner and some awards and a disco. That is really, really stressful, organising that. You know, as we leave the course, I'm doing all these calculations, who's done the best performances, who's done that, getting a speech really. But yeah, when you've got a few trophies there and they're all having a few drinks and enjoying it, makes it really worthwhile. And we've done that for years, even when we weren't really winning a lot. And people come from all over the country to do the national because they want to see their old mates and things like that and be part of it. And that takes a lot of work. I'd already got, unfortunately, the national was cancelled this year, but I'd already got some parents involved in looking at venues and helping on that side, because I do realise I've got to spread the load, if you like. And we, you know, when we put on the Bromley Twilight Meet or the Tunbridge Twilight Meet, the end of, what was it, 2019, wasn't it? When we put that on, we had a team of about 12. And we met round our dining room table about 5-6 times during the year. And everybody took on a little bit of responsibility. And that's the way to do it. And I think we can probably would aim to do that as we go forward a lot more, because, you know, we're quite lucky now. We're getting some guys in their 20s who are really contributing well to the club. In fact, the chairman, James Taylor, now at the moment, he's probably late 20s.
Wow, and, wow. Yeah.
You'll hear James on the video sometimes cheering on or making a bit of commentary. And he's a starter. He's a qualified starter. He promotes the sport at his school where he's at. And those are the sort of people where, yeah, I've always said over the years, if somebody says, oh, can I help? I've never said no. Mm. I've found something to do. And that's important as well. Surround yourself. Because, you know, even people helping put out the Tunbridge tents or taking them down, that takes a great weight off me on race day, or, you know, ticking them off and handing the numbers out. Yeah, I try and get something to do, lots of those little jobs, because the more little jobs covered by more people, the easier it is to lead something.
Yeah. Many people involved, yeah.
That's crazy you say about the club chairman. I did not know that at all. Like, I think that's amazing. You've got kind of a lot of younger people in what are traditionally roles for people who are maybe a little bit older.
James has come through the age groups. He enjoys cross country. He's never, I think he ran about 8:43 for 3,000 at one of those Watford nights, in his claim to fame. But he used to do the Trackside podcast with me about 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah, I've listened to a couple of them.
So James was on that. So he's grown up. He loves the sport. He's interested in the sport. And I think those sorts of people really need encouraging, because they're the future, you know. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, I think that kind of, we normally do like a part one and a part two for our podcast. I think that brings us nicely to the end of part one.
We touched on quite a bit, but where do you see, I mean, we know the current format of the sport at the moment, but do you see it changing at all? Like, we were talking about, you know, how there's not much money involved in it at all. Do you see the sport progressing at all and changing the structure and the dynamic? Or do you think, you know, for the next 15, 20 years, this would be it again? Same old.
Yeah, I jotted a few things down. I thought you might ask me something like this. And just one of the points I put down, which you haven't directly asked, but concerns me, is, and whether we're come out of where we are with a change, is the fixture list is just a complete mess.
I was gonna touch on that. I was gonna say, like, you know, the whole, you've got senior men's leagues through the summer, you got Watford, it's just, there seems like you say, there's no, with every other sport, you've got leagues, you know, that's it, or a cup competition. And there's just, in running, there's just so, it's too much to choose from almost.
Yeah.
And I think the spread has just sort of thinned out the competition, if you like.
Yeah, it's, you know, we we've grown up doing the Young Athletes League and the UK Development League in the summer and the County Cross Country in the winter. I don't know. It's they've become long days, a lot of effort from team managers. And the, you take the county championships. I don't know what your counties are like, but ours has gone really, you know, downhill in terms of participation. You know, I find it very difficult now to convince our lot to, the stronger runners to come back and do the county championships. If there was a meaning to it, and I've spoken to people like Matt Yates about this, you know, for a long, long time, you know, why don't you have a county championships or a tri-county championships early season? Part of the attraction is you then qualify for the regional championships, and the medalists from the regional championships get automatic qualification for the nationals. It starts to bring a bit of a meaning all the way through. Then you've got the situation where with the age groups, you've got the schools operating on one side and the club system on the other. You know, why have a county schools and a Kent championships? You know, it just gets so confusing and there's so many fixtures. And I would, if you had a blank piece of paper, you would not do it.
Yeah,
I believe you would do it as you would today.
Like you say, the problem is there's so many like different governing bodies. Like you've got the schools, you've got the, you know, the regional governing bodies and the, you know, England Athletics, then UK and England Athletics are different. You know, they don't really talk. It's just, like you say, the whole thing needs restructuring. But I love what you're saying about that qualification, because like when, you know, when you're junior, when you're in school, you have to do your county schools. I know I did. So I was Berkshire. So we had to do our county schools if we wanted to go to English schools, obviously. And then we had to do the Southeast Regional to then go to the English schools. And I think, you know, you have to finish top 16 in your county schools and then top 8 in the Southeast Inter-Counties match. And then, you know, then best 8, then go to the English schools. And that used to create quite a bit of buzz, you know, through the cross-country season. Them three races were like sort of your, you know, your big ones. And like you said, I think they should do something similar on the track. I like that idea.
Yeah.
It's very, very confusing for everybody. You know, it's, and I'm hoping, I haven't heard too much from her recently, but Joanna Coates, who's taken over as the chief exec at British Athletics, I think she's been looking at all of that sort of, and getting feedback, getting that sort of information. So you just be looking as we get back into normality, hopefully, that there will be some maybe subtle changes to start with, but things will start to change. I mean, they've merged. Tunbridge qualified. It was my son who did it, actually, because he was the team manager for the British League.
Yeah.
On the men's side. We have very strong depth on the men's side, enabling us to compete in the British League. Not so much on the women's side. It was Southern League there. But he pushed to get us a men's team in the British League. We got promoted first year and the second year. And then that's been disbanded and they've made this National League men and women together. And it never got off the ground last year because of the pandemic.
Yeah.
But it was starting to fray at the edges, to say the least, because how many clubs could get a really good, strong women's team out and a men's team out? Mm. And if they could, would it be any different from the Southern or the Northern leagues? And in the end, I think there's so few clubs that have gone into it. Actually winning it wouldn't mean anything. And that you need meaning to it. And another point, going back to what I was saying with the county champs, why don't they have the league or the club, the inter-club competition based on points? You know, like in the States where you get points for your university.
Mm. Yeah.
Why don't they make a club competition that's more meaningful? You know, where if the club can put a dozen people through to the regionals and the nationals, if you get there as a team as well, you know, there must be something in there to create a buzz. And make it meaningful to more people, and most importantly, to people supporting the sport.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, I think the problem running's got is it's just so, it's almost, I'm finding more and more, it's just getting so time orientated. Like you were saying, like winning seems to not mean anything these days. And I think that's partly because there's so many, you know, different races to win. And everyone knows that, I don't know, like most, you know, if you win a race, there's always, oh yeah, but the field is a bit watered down. You know, it wasn't the strongest field unless you get the British champs. But if we, like I say, a bit of restructuring and you had events, you know, which meant something, there was team titles or qualification processes, you would get more depth in fields. And winning a race, you know, would actually mean something a bit more over a time. And I think that's how the sport grows. You know, in football, teams don't play well, but they get to win. Yeah. And that's why people follow them. And it's not always pretty. But, and a lot of fans, they don't, like you say, they don't resonate to times. You tell someone your 1500 meter time. I know I tell my mates my 1500 meter time. They haven't got a clue, you know. But if you say, you know, you could say to them, oh, yeah, I won a race. You won your county champs, for example. They'll be like, oh, yeah, you're well good. You say to them, you come 10th in the national champs. They're like, what? You're rubbish, you know.
I mean, that's it. If you do win your county champs and it is the full field, that is like, that's a big race. That's the thing. Yeah. Like, or if you win the Southerns and things like that, if everyone turned up, these are huge titles and they should be viewed like that. But I think just these days, everyone kind of has to take everything with a bit of a pinch of salt, just because you don't know who's turned up, or even if there's been like a full field, or like, it's crazy, really. I think what you said, Mark, about like the qualification would be so good. And especially if they could put something on, maybe that if you like did really well in your Southerns or your England champs, you could get auto qualification for the British trials, maybe. So they have like a qualifying time for the top guys. So we're not maybe expecting our Olympians to rock up, but maybe there's like some kind of, like you mentioned America, like how they have the kind of wild card places just for some athletes, like who individually have maybe won the England champs, get auto to the 1500 at British champs, even if they don't have the qualifying standard. And I think, that's how you get those stories that you were talking about earlier of people who've kind of just had like a really good race and got through somewhere.
There's so much more clarity with the American national clubs. Everybody gets it, don't they? Everyone gets it. There's a big buzz around the team aspect as well as the individual aspect. You can publicise it. People talk to it. I mean, for heaven's sake, all the coaches, they rank the teams, don't they? I mean, it's pretty meaningless in a way, but they rank them all based on opinion leading up to it. And there's all this buzz around it. And I think that's lacking over here. It's been interesting, hasn't it, through lockdown, where you've taken out a lot of the clutter and there's just been a very few events on. There's that focused attention, which creates a buzz.
Yeah. And they've all been stacked as well, because there's not many events to choose from. Like me and Matt said last week, maybe that you kind of look any 5K, 10K up and down the country that would normally just be kind of just, could call it a fun run maybe. Like they're all finishing in kind of the top 10 guys are all or girls are really, really fast. And if there was a clear season that we kind of moved from this to this, I think it would work so well. And I'm not saying we could change to like an American season in terms of the cross to indoors to outdoors, but even if it was a little bit more geared towards that, to doing all three rather than people having to pick and choose.
Yeah. I think the other thing we're not traditionally very good at over here is as you get entries for events, the athletes' coaches have to play a part as well, you know, in terms of their commitment and say, yeah, I'm signing up for that event, I'll do it, and I will be there for sure. And then some publicity on the back of it can generate more good entries. Because people, the great thing about that, in my experience, people aren't ducking each other. You know, Mark Scott, absolutely brilliant. He will say, and I've heard Chris Barnes at Podium say, and he did with me with the Bromley Tri, he just said, I'd like to run. Is that all right? I said, are you sure? If you check with your coach, give me a minute. He goes off, Jerry Schumacher says, yeah, okay. And it's the quickest decision you could ever make. Now, if you get that from coaches and athletes, you can create some real events. But the organisers then need to publicise that, get more in, you know, more good quality in, and it creates that excitement plus the quality races anyway. So, you know, and I've said this to British Milers Club, you know, I get frustrated when people just don't know who's entering until like the Thursday before the Saturday, who's doing it and what race they're in and whether they're actually going to rock up at the end of the day. And all that's got to, it's not good. You know, you've got to be clear, you know, and some of the top athletes have been appalling over the years for, you know, not turning up when they said they would and things like that for no real reason. You know, when the summer season gets going and there's races in Belgium, you realise that, hang on, somebody's entered the Watford Grand Prix and they're competing in Belgium the same night. There's something wrong there, isn't there? You know, so I think we've all got a part to play to create that buzz. And then sponsors might come involved or the event becomes more of an occasion. And, you know, everyone you talk to on a podcast, you know, wants, you know, a beer tent and food available and on-course betting and all these things. They keep getting thrown about.
My dad definitely does. Yeah. Make it more exciting for him.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, imagine that.
I think you're right. Mark. So, like when I remember when all the Bromley Twilight or the Tonbridge Twilight was going down, you would do that. You would announce. You know, I seem to remember knowing that Mark Scott and people like James West were going to be doing that 3K quite a long way before. Yeah. And you're almost. I mean, I know I'm a fan and stuff, but you're almost sort of penciling in your diary. You're like, crikey, you know, in a couple of weeks on Friday, you know, these boys are going to be racing. That's worth watching.
Yeah.
And I think you can just create that buzz and a little bit more atmosphere.
Yeah. I think the only one, funnily enough, that I had a problem with that week was James, because he was on the short list. He was down in France training and he was like first reserve and getting the runaround from the meet promoter for Monaco. And here I am thinking, oh, James, no, we need you. We need you in this 3000 at Bromley. And trying to convince a lad like that, no, you've really got to commit to Bromley, whatever happens, in case there was a last minute call up for Monaco. Sounds a bit crazy, but I was desperate that he would do it because I knew the field was brilliant because you could only have five and a pacemaker in the race.
Yeah.
And it makes such a difference when you can match them up like that. And it was a bit breezy that night. And again, I'll keep singing Mark Scott's praises because I met him just beforehand. I said, you sure you're all right with the pacemaker going 61s, Mark? Yeah, if the other lads are up for it, I'm up for it. And that was it. So simple.
Just almost like that old school mentality.
Yeah.
That was an incredible race. It was 7:43 they ran. Yeah, it's like the fastest 3,000 metres on British soil for a while, you know, by like a diamond league.
Absolutely. And I mean, there was lots of people my age around who hadn't seen anything like that. Or, you know, it was Mark Vile, Phil O'Dell, Matt Yates, Chris McGeorge, they were all there and they just, you know, gobsmacked that these five lads could get on a train like that and just attack it. And, if they can do it, then others believe, don't they? You know.
Well, yeah, I hope it sets the tone for, you know, future meets that, like you say, people like, you know, James was umming and ahhing about getting on the Diamond League listing. And I hope it almost just athletes just start going, you know what? I know there's money incentives to the Diamond League and stuff. It was a bit of prize money for them at yours as well. But athletes just go, you know, I'll just race it out against fellow British athletes. And I think that, again, will just boost the publicity.
It's difficult because the Tunbridge meeting we put on, we got about £8,000 or £9,000 worth of sponsorship. But basically, it was a dozen of us at the club who got companies or were chipping in and things like that. That's how we did it. And for the Bromley meeting, there was a little bit of that. And as I say, England Athletics were very good.
Chipping
in. But I'd really like to say, right, first, second, third, I don't know, £500, £300, £150. Yeah, something reasonable rather than £50, £100, you know.
Yeah.
And for the Tunbridge one, we did pay some expenses and we put people up in hotels, but the timing was brilliant. And it again, goes back to the fixture list. If you get the timing of certain fixtures right, and it was a period where I can't remember what happened, but we suddenly got a bunch of Canadian 800 meter runners and American 800 meter runners who were in Europe looking for a race on the girls' side. And suddenly we had a stacked women's race with all these 2 minute 800 meter runners that are around looking, just looking for a race, not to get paid.
Yeah, it's
crazy. You know, that this is the sport we're involved in, that people like that are not being rewarded, well, nowhere near what you'd expect.
Yeah. And I think that's it. Like, you talk about these Belgian meets and all the Brits who go over there, but we need to be the ones in the UK getting people over here from Belgium and around Europe. Because it's clear, like Matt just mentioned, that Brits can run quick in Britain. Like, you don't need to go to Belgium to run fast. And I know, like, for a lot of people, it is a bit of an occasion and it's a bit of a holiday, and completely get that and fair play to people. But I think hopefully people realise that it doesn't have to be done for every race to get a good time. And if you've got good guys who want to kind of get together and help each other out in a race, then just attack it. Like you said, that people are going to be able to run their Olympic qualifying times or whatever it is at these meets in the UK.
Do you remember the Watford 3000 about 3 years ago, where 11 of them broke 8 minutes? It was just incredible.
I seem to recall you had to turn quite a few people down, didn't you, for that, who were like class athletes?
I did, but...
And obviously, that's not your fault, but not like...
I mean, it was a limit. Yeah. You can only have like 20 people in the race, whatever it was. Yeah. And but that was okay. Everyone was very supportive. They understood. I was open and honest, gave them updates, you know, who I could put into the race and your first reserve or second reserve. It was just that communication and people accepted it. And I was blown away that it's wrong, isn't it? There's people doing 8-hour round trips from Cardiff to come and do a race at Watford on a Wednesday night, or flying down from Scotland and staying with their aunt and uncle near Heathrow, you know, and doing the race and not getting anything for it, and other than the opportunity to run fast. And they did. That's why I love that about the sport, because there's so many people like it, just battling away, not for fame or glory or money. They just love it and they just want to compete against each other.
Yeah, definitely. And we always kind of, I always shout out like Watford meets on this podcast, just because I think they're so important for all age groups, really. Like you said earlier, you've got your like kind of. Your Olympians will rock up to the Grand Prix there, the BMC Knights or the gold standard. But then you've also got these under 13s who just want to come and knock out. Maybe it's an English school's time, but maybe it's just a 1 second PB or 20 second PB over 800 meters.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I just wonder how we, you know, it does, but there is a little bit more monetary incentive for people in this sport, and just how that grows. I've always thought that athletes need to seek a little bit more. I mean, we touched on it with a few on the podcast, didn't we, Lam? They need to seek sponsorship from they can't just expect Nike or Adidas to come in and just give them, you know, X amount kit, you know, and then you sort it, because that's only going to happen for the top one or two. You know, I know Zach as well, my brother. He, you know, he's not on British funding, but he's getting sponsorship from actual companies, tech companies in the local area. Like Bracknell and Paul Daly as well. And I just think, you know, if only more athletes could do that a little bit more, almost sell themselves a little bit more and reach out to companies, then they might be a bit more financially stable, and then the sport could sort of almost grow a little bit more as well. Because I think there are companies out there who are willing to, you know, they've got money to spend on that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's very difficult, isn't it? Because
you're
trying to sell yourself and promote yourself. There's that fine line between, you know, making people a bit fed up with you. There's some real social media stars out there, isn't there? And then as soon as you are sponsored, there's an immediate pressure in a way, isn't there?
Because there is.
If you get an injury or something, trying to explain that to somebody who's not involved in the sport and why you haven't raced for 6 months or something is very, very difficult. And there's that side to it. And I do feel you really need companies who have an understanding of the sport and the individual, don't you? And that's supportive. And we've got a few that, Nicole Taylor, who's won the England 10,000 meter championship, not last summer, the summer before, and has got international vests. She gets some local sponsorship. Not that she could ever, you know, give up a day job for it, but enough to help a little bit, which is really good. A local firm or two, and can be done. I'm not quite sure how you link the two. I go back to the national governing body. Perhaps they could link up potential sponsors with athletes somehow. I don't know. Certainly there's no harm. And I've heard athletes do it before. They just spend their day writing letters and explaining what they've done to local companies. And you never know. It just might hit the right person at the right time when their budgets have been decided. I mean, our company, I can remember we sponsored, probably 15, 20 years ago, a disabled tennis player, wheelchair tennis player. We sponsored him for 2 or 3 years, and that was quite expensive doing that. Running is relatively inexpensive to support. And it's just whether the company can make a good story out of you or whether you can help them in any way. And a lot of athletes have got the team environment, the dedication, the planning, and all this is a good story for a lot of companies to be able to build on, I would have thought.
I was always thinking, like, if more companies sort of maybe didn't just buy into one athlete, but buy into a club. Tonbridge, you like you say, raise some money and manage to get sponsorship. If more clubs are doing that, they might be able to almost... Because like you say, I think athletes, they go to races, they do it all off their own back. If they were able to... I mean, I think I remember Windsor used to do it sometimes. They used to pay all the expenses, and almost, I think they were paying athletes like 50 quid or something to a Brit League. I don't know if they still do. But if there was, just little things like that, because, most of the people, when they get to seniors, they're going to have a day job as well. But little things just to say to their, wife, partner, mates, like, I'm doing this, I'm going to have to keep giving up all these weekends. Just to, to excuse it a little bit.
Well, on that, I mean, Tunbridge over the years, we had an occasion where with your subscription, you could make a donation. And I think we raised about $4,000 on the back of that, donations alongside the subscription, just making that facility available. And then we've had other cases where we've had individuals chip in and sponsor. For example, anyone who goes to the British Athletics Championships gets their accommodation paid for and travel by the club because somebody's made some money available to do that. And that, going back to what somebody said earlier on, just that's a really good pat on the back and a recognition to those athletes in your club that have actually got to the national championships and qualified for it. Just makes them feel, well, actually, it was worth going. Not necessarily the money, but the club care that I've got here,
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting to say that because, I think, it's so good from clubs. And I know that there's, friend of mine, when he qualified for English schools, his school gave him, a certain amount of money, just for a new pair of spikes to wear to English schools. Yeah, and just £100 for a pair of spikes or something like that. And just, I think just little things like that, but shouldn't always be that the clubs and the schools have to. I think particularly as they're mostly, it's all kind of like volunteers and things like that, that we... I don't know. I think we should probably, like we mentioned, I'd probably expect more from higher up, but I don't know if we should expect it. But I think, maybe demand it is needed or something. I'm not sure what the answer is, obviously, but.
Well, linked in a way to some of this is a few of us were tasked with developing, it was a club development plan. And this was a year or so ago, where we'd sit down and meet and we'd gather ideas from others within the club. And one of my thoughts of what I thought was a good idea in a way to develop a club was the fact that there's a lot of knowledgeable people in the club about sport and fitness. There's facilities available and equipment available. In the meantime, outside the club system, there's personal trainers earning money from it. There's coaching, online coaching going on. So the clubs are doing everything for free. There's people, professionals making money out of it. And my idea was, we've got one of the country's top decathletes who's a member of the club. Utilize somebody like that, pay him a salary. He uses the facilities to run courses or classes for people. You know, I've heard of people, a group going to Battersea, running on a track, maybe doing some hurdle drills and stuff like that for as a fitness class. People paying 20, 30 quid for that class and having 50 people, yeah. It's that sort of thing. You've probably come across it more than I have, that sort of thing. And so clubs could do that. And then a couple of clubs caught my eye, one being Kilbarkan in Scotland, who have built their own indoor facility. And the first one I noticed was Lee Vale in Ireland, who have got a fabulous indoor facility with high jump, long jump throws, weights room, cardio room. It's like everything
that
their members can use, but they lease it out to schools and other people, etc. But everything I thought of in that idea meant that our club or any athletics club would become more like a business, and that would be the way forward. And then the pandemic came, and it was a journalist from a national newspaper got in touch. He lived locally and said, can I ask you some questions about how you're coping with the pandemic? And he said, how long do you think you'll last as a club? And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, financially, how long can you last? And it suddenly struck me that actually we're not at risk, because it's not professional. We're not having to lay people off. We're not having to put people on furlough. We haven't got all this loss of income necessarily. And so the world's changed. But before that pandemic, I was thinking, yeah, clubs could become more business-like and open themselves up a little bit more to bringing in income from outside. Quite jealous of the local rugby club. My brother's the membership secretary of the local rugby club. They charge for people watching the matches. They have a club dinner or lunch before the matches with about 200 people buy tickets and socialise. They have numerous sponsors.
Yeah.
Players are played a bit. They're semi-professional in the way they operate, and that's just a local club. And athletics is nowhere near that, is it? And it should, perhaps it should be, but of course it would have been a disadvantage at the moment because there's more issues thrown at you.
Sure. Yeah. I think that's a good place to end then. I think just on that little discussion about what could be done. I think we kind of always have these every week on the podcast. We're trying to kind of throw ideas out there for anyone listening who might be able to actually implement something in relation to them. Thanks very much for coming on, Mark. Really appreciate it, and I hope people enjoy this podcast, because I certainly have.
Thanks very much. Yeah.